produced by Preston Frazier, David Gordon, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 256, a bootleg from the solo album's tour.
Hi, this is Billy Sherwood of Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
This is John Davison, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Jeff Downes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Steve Howe, and you're listening to me on the Yes Music Podcast. Have a good time. Listen. Bye.
Hi, this is John Anderson. You're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 256 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine. Remember how you can get involved with the podcast, as always, via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. So here's this week's Yes Music Podcast patron update. Eddie Offord patrons are Preston Frazier, David Gordon, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall, who's new this week. Time and Word patrons are Joseph Cottrell, Jeffrey Cresselius, Michael O'Connor, Paul Tomei, and Julio Scissors. And Yes patrons are Paul Wilson, Jamie McQuinn, Miguel Falcao, Ken Fuller, David Pannell, Joost Maglev, Brian Sullivan, Jeremy North, and new this week, Tim Stannard. And also, of course, continued thanks to Robert as well. Thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. The Yes Music Podcast website migration will be live next Wednesday, but hopefully you won't notice any differences. Please do help by checking the site and your access to YMP episodes on Wednesday so we can resolve any issues. If you'd like to join our first patrons in helping to support the show, just head over to patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for details of how to get involved. That's patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast. Apologies to Craig Tieran for producing his name incorrectly previously, and thank you to him for clarifying that he was the one who sent along the Elias live recording video link last week. Graham asks via email about the old chestnut of whether Steve Howe's solo piece is the clap or clap. My understanding is that it's always supposed to have been just clap, and it was wrongly named on the Yes album and wrongly introduced by John Anderson there as well. Let us know your understanding of it. Several listeners have had the pleasure of seeing live Yes-related music this week. It was great to see Doug Curran with our friend Tom Brislin at a Renaissance concert, and Joseph Cottrell posted three fascinating photos of his ARW experience, including a guy with an original 1994 Talk Tour t-shirt. Nice. And here's Joseph's concert report. He says, "Probably not so much of a coherent review as a collection of random thoughts cobbled together. I decided not to take any photos during the show, the same as I did not for the Yes concert back in September, as there are just so many pics and videos of the band out there already that I really couldn't add much, and I just wanted to enjoy the show. I didn't take down the set list either, as my phone's battery was about dead. That being said, they seem to have pretty much settled on a set list, and a tiny bit of research yielded me the exact show we just saw. Cinema, Perpetual Change, a slightly truncated version, Hold On, I've Seen All Good People, Lift Me Up, prefaced by a Lou Malino drum solo, and You and I, Rhythm of Love, Heart of the Sunrise, Changes, Long Distance Runaround / The Fish, The Meeting, Awaken, Owner of a Lonely Heart, and Roundabout, also the truncated version without the midsection for the encore. It was just about exactly 2.5 hours and started promptly on time at 8 p.m, which seems to be an added plus for any concert featuring really old guys. The marquee out at the front at the marvellous venue was completely accurate. An evening of Yes Music Plus, the plus being the single ABWH song The Meeting, which provided a nice bit of calm between the storms of fishiness and awaken. But this is definitely not Yes. It was Yes music, but with a much harder edge. Some of that was, of course, due to the differences between Steve Howe's and Trevor Rabin's guitar styles, but also to the heavy, heavy drumming of Lou Malino. He may have started out emulating a bit of Bill Bruford and Alan White, and he's kept all the tastiest licks where you would expect to hear them, but he's definitely brought his own style of drumming to this music. He's loud and hard and thumpy, and it's just fine for this band. But this band is not Yes. The concert I saw at the beginning of September had a whole different feel to it, and it felt like Yes. High points of the evening were And You and I, Heart of the Sunrise, Lee Pomeroy's excellent version of / tribute to Chris Squire's The Fish, Awaken, of course, although Rick did seem to get a bit lost wandering around in the church organ wilderness before bringing things back to a stupefying finale, and Trevor and Rick's extended solos and foray into the audience during Owner. As for musicianship, Trevor has managed to grind all of the rust off his live playing. He was absolutely on fire throughout the whole show. His singing, however, well, he's a 62-year-old still trying to sound like a 32-year-old who originally sang all those power prog pop hits from the 80s, and it's not quite working so well. He's fine when the pseudo Yes Choir is in action, but he sounds like he's straining a lot on the solo stuff. Also, I don't think it's wise of him to be wearing spandex on stage at his age, especially if he's going to be spending quite so much time with his back to the audience. Enough said. John sounded just absolutely fine the whole night, and this is what I was really worried about, especially since they played in Denver at the Paramount Theatre, another great old theatre I've been to, the very night before on the 16th. He flubbed a note during a song, I can't remember which, and it was so obvious that he just made a face as if to say, well, hell, I'm 74 after all. Laughed a bit and went right on. Rick. He seemed to be having a grand old time touring again, perhaps because we're all pretty sure this is going to be it for the grumpy old man. He seemed to have a bit of a cold, however, as I saw him pull a rather well-used-to-be-kind handkerchief out of his left pants pocket and blow his nose repeatedly throughout the show. Didn't seem to affect his performance at all, and it was quite obvious that he and Trevor truly do enjoy playing together live. Lee Pomeroy really does live up to Rick's estimation of him. I don't think there's any bass guitar role he could not fill. I've seen him quite a bit recently, watching Steve Hackett's Genesis Revisited videos. His digitally looped version of The Fish is truly something any Chris Squire fan should see, and with a bit of Silent Wings thrown in. Lou Molino is just absolutely solid. He's a very good drummer, but he's definitely not Alan White or Bill Bruford. He also helps out with the harmonies and background vocals, and that brings me to a thing. Chris Squire's absence is very obvious, both with ARW and the current version of Yes. Billy Sherwood is doing an admirable job filling Chris's shoes with Yes, and while four out of the five ARW members also sing, the contrapuntal melodies and lyrics of some very fundamental Yes music were sadly missing from this performance. John and Trevor delivered everything you'd expect from the Rabin-era songs, and while Lee Pomeroy provided harmony vocals with John for most of the evening, along with Lou Molino, the counter-melodies and alternate parallel lyrics on And You and I and Awaken were very noticeably missing. Chris was so much at the foundation of everything that is Yes music that when his bits go missing, it's very sadly obvious. But I don't want to end on a sour note, so I'll wrap this up with, wow, this was a really great concert. It was Yes music by a band that is almost Yes. Despite all the quotes about how it really is a great five-piece band, the reality is that the name is still Anderson, Rabin, Wakeman. Kevin, I hope you get a chance to see them when they head for the UK and Europe. Mark, unfortunately, I guess you're SOL again. Sorry, Canada. So, very, very many thanks, Joseph. Fantastic to hear your thoughts, particularly about ARW not being Yes. Get ready for some discussion on that one. There's also a review from Stephen English. He says, hi there, Mark and Kevin. I've been a Yes fan since 1971. My first Yes concert was at Newcastle City Hall, 1973, Topographic Oceans Tour. An uncomfortable night for a 13-year-old, I can tell you. I was determined to like it, even if it was in truth hard work apart from the encore. However, last night, November the 12th, 2016, I went to my umpteenth version of a Yes show, ARW in San Antonio, Texas. They were brilliant. They had so much fun on stage and the set was very tight. The sound was excellent, well after the first three songs, where the guitar seemed to be lost in the mix. Rick really carried the show. He was in excellent form. He was truly having fun. John's voice was perfect. The songs have so much more meaning when he is singing them, and he really was enjoying himself. He even talked to us, and those who follow Yes know how awkward his links are sometimes. They played the usual set. Awaken was perfect. No idea where all the disjointed stories are coming from. Trevor Rabin was excellent. The bass was in the middle of the sound, so all the earlier comments about it not being in the mix enough have been heeded. And Lee Pomeroy is a fantastic bass player. The drummer, Lewis Molina III, is extremely good, a mix of Bruford and White. There was a lot of energy, and everyone at San Antonio had a blast, apart from the guy who tried to get to the front about 20 times before passing out drunk by the fifth song. There were some empty seats. My advice to everyone out there is go. You will not regret it. They are fantastic, and it's a great show. Only downer? The rip-off merchandising, $35 for a t-shirt. So, thanks, Stephen. Despite the merchandise prices, I agree with your advice about going to see the show and I can't wait for my turn. Over on Facebook this week, Mark posted a huge number of fascinating items, some of which we will mention later, so do check those out. Preston posted the latest Something Else review he has reached. Drumroll, Tomato! Future Times / Rejoice is first up. Add your thoughts on Facebook. I've pre-ordered the John Kirkman Dialogues book, so that's something to look forward to. And on Twitter, I was interested to see Jeff Downes tweeting about working with Trevor Horn. That sounds tantalising, and maybe will lead to Yes with Trevor producing. Who can say? So many thanks to everyone who's been involved in any way this week, not least those who have kept the discussions as vibrant as ever on the show notes.
This is the YMP Album Review from the Great White North with Mark Anthony Kay.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to another edition of the YMP Album Review. So today we're going to do something a little bit different, and we're going to be doing a bootleg live concert recording. So as Kevin posted last week, the show in question is during the solo albums tour in 1976. It was recorded on May 28th, 1976, live in Roanoke, Virginia. So that's really all the information that there is about this show. It is, from what I understand, the first night of the show, if I'm not mistaken. And by the looks of the set list here, which we'll get to in a minute, it probably is the first, if not then really, really close to the beginning of the tour. But I'm pretty sure this is the first date of the tour. So let's talk about bootleg records for a minute. So bootleg records to me are kind of like wine. There's a lot of wine out there. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, some of them are really good. How do we know the difference? Well, one of the ways to pick out wine is to, you know, smell it, to, you know, take a look at it in the light, and to taste it, of course. But, and also region sometimes has something to do with it. I know we're getting a little off course here, but just bear with me. Sometimes they tell you that wines from Tuscany are always good to drink, but I had a bottle once that tasted like somebody washed their socks in the bottle. So don't always be convinced just on reputation. As far as bootleg CDs go, the best way to figure it out, if you're looking for them on YouTube, is to take a look at the rating of the recordings. Now, an audience recording is always going to be shaky, in my opinion. And the higher the rating, it's sort of like in school. Grade A is considered the best, and A plus the very best. C and D, not so good, and usually to be avoided because they sound like they were recorded beside a cement mixer. The best ones you'd want to take a look at are the ones that are soundboard recordings, which is basically they shunt all the tracks from the mixing board to a cassette player through a stereo output from the mixing board. And according to how the sound man mixes the sound, that's how the sound will appear on the cassette. And usually it'll be really good because there's no audience talking and noises, all kinds of noises and ringing and feedback. You'll get the clear sound right from the microphone to the cassette recorder. And usually it makes for a really, really good recording. Sometimes, and very rarely, sometimes even better than some live albums I've heard, like actual release ones. So where does this one stand in that realm of categorization? Well, according to the YouTube channel here, where this gentleman posted the recording, he gave it an audience recording quality of a B-. Now, I think that's being a little generous, in my opinion. It took me about 3 songs to finally get comfortable with listening to this before I could even start making out what was being played here. The recording is a little shaky. But being a sound engineer, I decided to shunt it through my Pro Tools rig, do a little bit of creative equalization, and made it that much easier for me to listen to. So let's take a little walk through what was played. So the set list, which was basically the Apocalypse intro, Siberian Katru, I've Seen All Good People, Ram, Hold Out Your Hand, You By My Side, Roundabout, Break Away From It All, Beginnings, One Way Rag, Alan White solo, Song of Innocence. Oh, here's that word again. Kachika, which is that song from the Patrick Mraz solo album. Sound Chaser, Harp Solo, Heart of the Sunrise, and Sweet Dreams. So being that this is supposed to be a solo album tour, if you take a look at the set list, there's a heck of a lot of solo songs on here. In fact, when they take a good look here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 songs are only actual Yes songs. The rest of the set list are solo songs, which are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8. And if you count the harp solo, that's technically 9. more than half of the set list on this show is solo material. How was the solo material on here? Well, let's talk about Ram for a minute. Compared to the actual solo album, it's not a bad version. I mean, again, you have to kind of, you know, really listen hard to hear what he's playing, because like I said, this is hardly a very clear recording of it, but the performance of it on the whole is pretty good. I mean, keep in mind that the actual version on the album, he has banjo, washboard, all kinds of other instrumentation, but he pretty much played a straight up acoustic guitar version of the song, which pretty much focused on the main melodies and figures in the song. So it was a pretty good representation of the song. Next up was Hold Out Your Hand and You By My Side, which segued together. Now, Hold Out Your Hand, I thought, went over really good. I thought they played it well. Patrick Mraz did a great job with the organ work, and the band as a whole played the song very well. Chris sang it really good, which was fantastic. But the interesting thing is when they segued into You By My Side, I felt that it kind of lacked a little something in that playing of that song. There's a lot of space on it, and there's a lot of space on the studio recording, but because on the studio you can add reverb and stuff like that and different kinds of studio trickery to make it sound full and nice, this sort of didn't appear on this version of it live. Now, granted, this is the first playing of it as a band, so you got to give them a little bit of slack for that, but Hold Out Your Hand turned out fantastic. This one, not so much. I mean, maybe it just needed a little bit more work, but I found that this was a little bit more of a shakier song. Maybe not so easy to translate the studio version into a live situation, which happens sometimes. Interesting to note that after this song, they went into Roundabout. Now, Roundabout was usually a closer of the set. Why they put it in so early into the set list, really just half an hour into the show, this is very interesting. I'd really love to find out why they did that. But in any case, the next song after Roundabout was Break Away From It All, which is from Steve's solo album again, which was another Steve song, so that's two in a short period of time. This song, ironically enough, I'm not sure why they played it. I mean, it's not like they played it terribly, but you know my feelings about Steve and singing. And Steve Howe obviously sang this, and maybe it was a bit better than the studio version. Like I said, it's a little hard to hear some of the nuances and the subtleties of the recording, but it was decent. I guess overall what I'm trying to get at is the recordings themselves might still be a shade better than the live performances, but that only maybe because this is just their early performances of them. The one thing that I don't like about this song in general was just I never liked Steve's singing to begin with, but as a whole, as a band performing it, it's very interesting to hear their take of it, because it's not exactly note for note. There is a little bit of interplay and a little bit of difference in it, which is interesting, and it turned out pretty good on a whole, and I'll give it that. After that was a song that I really didn't expect to see in a live setting, which is Beginnings. Now, this is a full orchestra piece on Steve Howe's record, and funny enough, this is the third Steve Howe song in under 45 minutes that we hear. You know, mercifully, there's no singing in this, but there's also no orchestra on this either. This is just mainly Steve on a classical, or I'm pretty sure it's an acoustic guitar, because it's really hard to pick out. I'm pretty sure it's a classical that he was using on this. Like I said, the quality makes it a little tricky to hear. It is an interesting song. Why he put this on there, or why they put this in the set list, I'm not really entirely sure, because it is a song that probably requires more of an orchestra to make it more fully realized. And of course, this is not, you know, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. They're not going to be dragging a live orchestra with them on stage. Well, at least not yet. So, Beginnings. Interesting piece. Why they played it, I'm not sure. Next, we get to One Way Rag, which is off of Alan White's solo album, Ramshackled. Now, here's the interesting thing with this. Out of all the solo pieces on here besides Chris's, I actually find that Alan White's music on here, which is One Way Rag and Song of Innocence, translated live a lot better than it probably did on album. I actually like Yes's version of these songs much better than I do his actual solo album versions of this, which is maybe surprising to some, maybe not. But if you were to listen to this record, live bootleg, maybe some of you might agree with this, because I think they played this really well. The song is strong. Song of Innocence, for example, I think John did a fantastic job singing it, you know. He really hit everything perfectly. The band played everything really well. And it's one of the surprise songs of the set list, I find. That leads us on to Patrick Mraz's solo piece, which is that Kachika. I'm never going to get that pronounced right. Interestingly enough, they played this actually really well also. Again, maybe not as accurately as the solo album version, but of course there was all kinds of Brazilian percussion and stuff like that, which all of which was not present during this concert, I'm sure. But the performance of it overall is really well done. They try to stay as true to the recording as possible, and I can't say much more than Patrick Mraz shows his strength as a keyboard player on this song. And not to mention that right after this song, they jump into Sound Chaser. Now, what a 1-2 punch that is, because we all know that Sound Chaser is a tour de force for Patrick Mraz, as well as Alan White, who does some brilliant drumming on that. So those two songs really kind of made me sit up in my seat a little bit more and take attention to it. Right after that, we have the harp solo, which was a little bit of a more easy, laid-back listening part of the concert. John did a great job playing his harp. Then after this nice little harp piece, we're led into the last two songs, which are Yes songs, which is Heart of the Sunrise, which ironically, I also found out that this was Patrick Mraz's first live performance of Heart of the Sunrise was at this actual concert. And then they end off the show with Sweet Dreams. So overall, a very interesting set list in the fact that they have so much solo material on here. Some of it is played better than others. I will say that Chris's songs were done probably the best, followed by Alan's, funny enough. I think that his songs turned out really well. And it's interesting how they also put a Alan White drum solo in between those two pieces that he did. And I think it really went well for a little, you know, triad of an Alan White section there. Would I recommend this live show? Probably not, mainly because I think it's just not the best sounding one. There are also some other ones that you can find on YouTube as well, if you're interested to hear that time period. One of them, there's a show that came out on June 5th in 76, from Jackson, Missouri, I think it is. No, sorry, Jackson, Mississippi, sorry. It's also a B audience recording, but it also had, you know, Song of Innocence, Hold Out Your Hand. Funny enough, they had dropped most of Steve Howe's material by this point and had gone back to using Leaves of Green instead of any of his solo material. And Patrick Mraz's song is gone as well, but this is also a slightly better version of the concert. But if you really want to hear a good concert from the 76 period, I think the one to listen to is Live from Detroit, Michigan in September. Is it September? No, it would be August 17th, 1976. And while this is still considered a solo album's tour, there is virtually nothing of the solo material left on this. There's only really the harp solo left here and Patrick Mraz's solo, which has a little bit of his solo material on here. If you want to get a good example of what a soundboard source A-plus quality recording sounds like, then you want to look up this one. Once again, Detroit, Michigan, 8/17/1976. So August 17th, 1976. You'll find it on YouTube. And that is how a really fantastic bootleg recording should sound. Again, it doesn't have the solo material, but it's a great show from that time period. So, I know I rambled on a little bit about various different things and not so much about the actual show itself, but I thought it was important to point out these things because sometimes people, when they hear a bootleg show, they get turned off of them immediately because of the quality of it. And I just wanted to make sure that people realize that there are also very good live concerts to be heard out and about on the internet. So out of a 10, I would probably give this recording a 5. Maybe, okay, you know what? I'll give it a 6. I'll give it an extra point because historically, it is probably the best show to listen to if you want to hear a little bit of the solo material, or actually a lot of the solo material in a live setting. So if you're interested in hearing the live material, check this one out. Save it to your computer and maybe fool around with the EQ settings and maybe make it a little bit more listenable for your own hearing. And maybe it might become one of your favorites. Who knows? So until next week, this is Mark Anthony Kay saying bye for now.
So I've been listening to a live bootleg of Yes Live in 1976 on the solo album's tour. This seems to be the first concert in the solo album tour, and the band started off by including quite a few solo album numbers. The recording is okay, despite being rated as B- by the poster. First to get an airing was Ram from Steve Howe's solo album Beginnings. Played straight after I've Seen All Good People, this is fast and furious and fills the same role as Clap and Mood for a Day. Howe's performance is, as you'd expect, sparkling and energetic. A great palate cleanser before we launch straight into the next piece, Chris Squire's Hold Out Your Hand / You By My Side. Here we have Patrick Mraz providing the organ at the beginning, sitting in for Barry Rose, and it's a surprisingly good pipe organ sound, despite not being the real instrument used on the record. Squire takes centre stage, and the whole band sounds really similar to the recording. Alan White's drums are just right, and Squire's vocals are brilliant live. This track works very well indeed, with Squire leading from the front. It's a rousing rendition, and the band sounds like it's really on top of the song. No early tour issues here, as far as I can hear. Squire's soloing is great, and it's a treat to hear him in a Yes context, playing a different kind of solo. I'm surprised at how good the performance is, despite the song being adopted by the band. The vocals go a tiny bit astray at the beginning of You By My Side, but are soon back on track. This part actually works less well in the live situation. It's a bit more laid back, and the space it leaves seems a bit empty, despite some attractive Mraz soloing, which tends to meander a bit. Perhaps ending the first track more definitely would have been better. It's still a good rendition with that wonderful walking bass pattern and a bit of Steve Howe's guitar thrown in for good measure, but it ends up not feeling as strong as the previous track. The crowd seemed to enjoy it, though. Roundabout comes next, and then the next solo track, Howe's Break Away From It All, which is briefly introduced by John Anderson, I think. Howe's playing is great, but his singing suffers from the same problems as on the record. It also sounds very far down in the mix here. The band approach the song with gusto, and it goes with something of a swing, but even the great Howe finger-picking and runs can't really add enough interest to make this a live track which stirs the emotions. There's not much to hang on to, and Howe's guitar breaks sound a bit forced. The vocal harmonies, which presumably feature Anderson and Squire, although I'm not sure, are fairly weak, and it just never really takes off properly as a live performance. Is part of this down to the lack of Squire-created bass line? I'm not sure. It's certainly a showcase for Howe histrionics, and Mraz spices it up with a quick sci-fi sound at the end, but overall it's pretty unmemorable. Then I'm somewhat surprised to see Beginnings is next on the set list. Symphony Orchestra is not present as far as I know. How will this be done then? Well, Steve Howe starts off in acoustic guitar mode, but this opening doesn't have the hooks of his other solo acoustic pieces, and you can hear the audience getting a bit restless, I think. It's good Howe soloing, but the material just doesn't come over well. Right, he's finished, and it turns out to be just the solo acoustic guitar part of Beginnings, rather than the whole piece, which of course makes perfect sense. Now we're thrown straight into the jamming feel of Alan White's One Way Rag. It's starting to feel like a long time since the last Yes music in this concert, although it's only a matter of just over 8 minutes. Maybe that tells you what you need to know about the preceding solo works. This is an attractive groove, actually, with some great guitar sliding from Howe and a powerful rhythm section pinning it all down. It's laid back to the point of being horizontal, and you can't help nodding your head to the music. Anderson's soaring vocals are a great addition to the song, and Mraz's piano keeps the motion going. This is one track like Hold Out Your Hand, which seems to work rather well in this band setup. It can never be a major part of a concert, but as a diversion it's enjoyable, a bit like when Queen used to throw in Big Spender, just for fun. This leads into Alan White's drum solo, which is remarkable, but we're not looking at that today. After he finishes his histrionics around the kit, there's yet another solo piece. This time we're back to Alan White's ramshackle for Song of Innocence, one of the better tracks, I seem to remember, and here we have Anderson, White and Howe, who all appeared on the record, playing it live, so should we expect it to sound good? Let's see. It's certainly a peaceful and attractive start. It's a naive-sounding song, but I like Anderson's vocal line and the Mraz piano complements it well. Squire's curlicue bass interjections are pleasant additions, and it sounds like waves washing up and down a beach at times. Once again, I'm wondering if it fits into this live event, though. It's perhaps nothing more than a pleasant pop tune which doesn't really travel very far, or particularly convincingly. It's maybe a bit too constrained for this kind of an event. I don't want to be too hard on the song, it works fine, but I just wonder if it's the right thing to play in a Yes concert. The final solo album piece is Patrick Mraz's Kinshasa. This is a whirlwind of excitement from the first blasts of keyboard sound. Squire's bass is blisteringly powerful and Alan White's drums a towering presence as well. Mraz's piece feels like a sister effort to Sound Chaser, which is interestingly the next track in the concert. Piano is mellow and it sounds like tapes are included rather dramatically in the performance. Alongside Chris Squire's, this is the only other real prog-sounding work of the solo selection, and Mraz takes us on a piano flight of fantasy, which manages to keep the interest where other tracks didn't. Classical and jazz influences engage in a tussle to the death until a honky-tonk feel takes over, providing shouts from the audience. It's huge fun and then suddenly changes via keyboard, glissandi into the Latin American rhythms we were waiting for. It sounds like Chris Squire gets involved with the vocals, and even though the rhythms track is recorded, it still seems to work. Mraz continues with a lot of solo piano, which is always fascinating. It's perhaps a little disjointed with bits of recorded material cropping up. It would be good to know what was going on visually during some of this electrical storm activity. And then suddenly we do move into Sound Chaser, which is of course absolutely the last word in progressive music. Actually, it serves to remind us that however good this solo album content is, it pales dramatically into insignificance against something like proper Yes content, like Sound Chaser. Overall, I think the inclusion of the solo tracks here is interesting, and some of it works well, particularly Hold Out Your Hand. But in the end, I just find myself waiting, and sometimes not too patiently, for the next bit of classic Yes material. I can see why the band decided to drop the tracks. On Forgotten Yesterdays, Alan White's interview from Notes from the Edge is quoted, where he says, about why they dropped the whole idea, "We didn't think it really worked as part of the stage set, to promote each individual album as part of the stage show. It just wasn't gelling with the rest of the set. For what reason, I don't know." So in the usual pattern, I'm now joined by Mark. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. So there we are, a bootleg, and in fact, the first concert from that solo album's tour. And one thing which stuck out to me, I suddenly realised when I got to the end of that, is no Elias of Sun Hillow. Why not?
Yeah, that was a very interesting question. One that I think that lots of people who might have listened to this probably wondered, because there were as many as three songs from Steve.
Yep.
And even Alan had two songs, and there was nothing from John. I mean, apart from a harp piece, which I don't think had anything remotely to do with Elias, I don't believe.
No.
But
no.
I would venture to think that maybe he just thought it too complicated. And yeah. I don't mean that musically, but maybe vocally, because he does do a lot of vocal things on the record. So maybe it was just something that they couldn't reproduce as easily as the other songs, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the story of I stuff, of course, is complicated. And I thought that was, it sounded a little bit patched together, that, because there were certainly some bits of tape used in that, and it didn't seem to hang together as well as it could have done. And perhaps Elias just would have been a step too far, as you say. The concert itself, though, just speaking about that as a whole concert experience, I was a bit concerned about that as well, because as you pointed out, there were more solo tracks than Yes tracks played. So it seemed that the balance of it was slightly odd, and perhaps it's not surprising that they dropped most of the solo tracks later. How did it feel as a whole concert to you?
Well, I did listen to it about three times in its entirety, twice on my system in my recording room, in my studio, and then once on headphones in my own room. And when I listened to them both three times there, I just found that it sort of felt odd. It didn't have the same feeling as listening to a Yes concert, because while I was very familiar with those songs, it was almost like experiencing a concert where you go see a band and they're suddenly playing material that you're not too familiar with. And every time a Yes song came on, you were like all excited all of a sudden, like, okay, here's one I know, you know, even though I knew the material, it just seemed, if they would have put a song each from each of them, I think it would have hung together better than having as many songs as they had.
Mm. Yes, absolutely right. And it was fascinating. I had a look at Forgotten Yesterdays again to have a look and see how many times that Yes have played all those different pieces, and found out some fascinating things. So in the order that they appear in the concert that we listened to, Ram has been played 51 times, but that's perhaps not surprising, as it's a Steve Howe solo piece, and you can come back to that and play it in different contexts. It's absolutely fine. So 51 times across the years, really. Hold Out Your Hand, You By My Side, only played 10 times, all on the solo album tour. Break Away From It All, only managed to survive four outings, and then it was consigned to the historical dustbin or whatever. Beginnings, seven times, because Steve again came back to that and played it in a solo spot in 1991 and twice in 2009, but only seven times. One My Rag, again, like Break Away From It All, only managed four. Song of Innocence was played 10 times, and that's interesting because both of us thought that was not too bad live. And I think, and we need someone to tell us about this, but I think I've worked out how to pronounce the Patrick Mraz song. I looked it up on the internet, and I think it's Kasasha, something like that.
Yes.
But we, okay. we need someone to tell us. But that's only been played four times as well. And in the end, there's been very little written about or spoken about the solo album's tour. And even in the interview that I read on Notes from the Edge, Alan seemed to be very, very hazy about the details of exactly what they did play and exactly why they stopped doing it. He just said, as I pointed out, that it just didn't go well. It didn't feel right to be playing those. And they radically altered the set list from that point on, really. So 10 times was pretty much the most that they managed to come back to things like Songs of Innocence, and they binned the rest. So perhaps it's not surprising.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was very surprised how well Alan's stuff came across live. But I mean, I found it odd to hear songs like Beginnings. I mean, on studio record, they're so vast and so lush and so much stuff going on to it. Just hear it with a singular guitar, it almost seemed a little bit head-scratching at first hearing it. I mean, same thing with Ram. I mean, even though it's not as dense on record, but there's still also a washboard and banjos and all kinds of stuff, and he's confined down to one real stringed instrument to do it. And while all these pieces sounded fine, I think that's one of the reasons why maybe it didn't survive, because it just didn't seem to be a band piece. It just seemed to be a piece that just Steve did, and he did, you know, three pieces, two by himself and one with the band.
Yeah. It's a shame in a way, I think, that something like Hold Out Your Hand wasn't played more, because I did think that did go really well, and it seemed to work well in that live situation and with those musicians. But in the end, I suppose it's a bit of an interesting Yes diversion for us diehard fanatics, but not something they came back to, perhaps for good reasons. So let us know what you think, particularly if you were there and you managed to catch one of the concerts on the solo albums tour. Tell us what you thought of it, and did you see one of those first ones, or did you go when they'd pretty much abandoned the whole idea? So let us know on the show notes for this episode.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrine.
Right, we're back again with Mark to talk about this week's Two Pence.
Yes, so this week, I've been posting a bunch of different Yes-related albums in different various formats, and it did get us talking a little bit about the various different formats in which you can enjoy Yes music.
Yes, that's right. And of course, there will always be the fans who believe that vinyl is the only proper way to listen to Yes music, and you can think about the kind of romantic ideal of a vinyl record coming out of the sleeve. It's quite a sensuous experience, and it's quite a ritual, isn't it, to get the beautiful black disc out, or different colour disc perhaps, and put it on the turntable and get the arm. It's a very mechanical act, isn't it, really? And of course you've got those sleeve art and the notes there, and the size, the smell, the feel. It's wonderful stuff, vinyl, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that people missed. And when the whole digital phenomenon started, I think that's something that people really started to miss after a while, because when you were just getting music through computer in MP3 form and just had a little small, you know, reproduction of a cover that you had to squint on the screen to look at, you know, people yearned for the days of when you could have a nice big album cover in front of you and really explore it while you listen to the music.
Yes, that's right. And we'll come back to digital in a minute. But what came in between vinyl and the most recent digital formats? Let's have a think about it. But before we go on to those, what do you think about audio quality? I mean, there's a vast different range of, as we talked about before, different range of types of vinyl even. Do you think vinyl sounds better?
That's a really tricky question to answer, because I think a lot of it has to do with nostalgia a bit too. And I think a lot of it has to do with what the ear likes to hear, because people always like to use the term warm and, you know, stuff like that when they describe analog mute, like analog sort of sources, like a vinyl record, right?
Yeah.
Now, of course, we could get into a great big discussion about the whole actual analogness of vinyl records as opposed to digital, because nowadays when bands are reissuing records, they are not always coming from an analog source, but that's just another whole thing that we could get into. But, you know, analog, like, let's vinyl records, they sound good. People sometimes enjoy hearing a little bit of the crackle and the pop, and that almost makes it seem familiar to you, like when you were younger and you had your first record player and your first records, and people like to have those memories, and it does sound warmer. That whole medium of the vinyl record, it takes the music, and when you put it on to the source like that, something happens to it that we seem to enjoy listening to.
Yeah.
Sort of the same way, like cassette is the same thing, right?
Well, yeah, I was going to come on to cassettes next. And of course, there is that whole vinyl resurgence. It's very much of the moment, vinyl. But the first way I heard Yes music was actually taped from the vinyl onto cassette. I shouldn't really own up to that, should I? But those two first albums, 90125 and Tormata, that I first heard were taped for me onto cassette, onto audio cassette. And I recently watched a very interesting video, because cassettes have got a very bad name over the years, of course, because a lot of, you know, the tape used to stretch and warp and sound dreadful, and it was easy to break the things. But yes, I watched this video recently which said that actually if you've got the right kind of cassette, good quality cassettes, and if you've got the right kind of 1980s, in fact, they mentioned specifically 1980s good quality tape decks, in fact, you can get really good sound quality from tapes. So what's your opinion of tapes?
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head, because while people say, you know, it got a bad rap for, you know, stretching and for getting caught in stuff and, you know, into your car stereo, all of a sudden your favorite cassette is all, you know, screwed up and you're screaming at the car, right? But you know what? The fact of the matter is, having worked in a studio for a long time myself, the two-track mastering machines, of which everybody now herald and pray that their vinyl records come from this source, it's essentially the same thing. It's a tape, and the music is on that. And a lot of the times when people are going to get these old tapes out to reissue them or whatever, you better believe these people are praying with their rosary that these tapes don't get caught in these machines.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times they have to get baked because the oxide on it starts peeling off.
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing that people complained about with cassettes happen to two-track master tapes. So really, if you're going to complain about cassettes, you're going to need to complain about the master. And really, that just seems like not a wise thing to do, because after all, everybody seems to want to have their music from this master, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. I'd love to sing your Big Generator cassette, which you put on Facebook recently, because I've got exactly the same cassette. It's not nicely shrink-wrapped like yours is, but that was how I first listened to Big Generator. I remember that being a great experience. But cassettes, okay, we're okay with cassettes. But going back a little bit further, and we heard that brilliant story, didn't we, from Jamie McQuinn a couple of weeks ago about his first Yes 8-track tape, which he put in his car, and in fact it turned out not to be Yes at all. And I think you've posted an 8-track or so, certainly people have on the Facebook group, and also Dave Watkinson showed us an 8-track of Elias, I think, recently. But 8-tracks I have actually no personal experience of whatsoever. What's the differences with them? Obviously, there's a short amount of time on them, but what do you know about those?
Well, I mean, essentially the theory is sort of similar to tape. I've always heard, now I don't exactly have a vast collection of 8-tracks myself. I believe I only have one somewhere. And nice. I believe it's a Styx one. I have to admit, the main stickler point with the 8-track has always been the fact that it always seemed to mess around with the sequencing of the songs. People always used to complain that you know, how it appeared on cassette or on vinyl was never the same on 8-track because of the way the programming falls within the 8-track tape. Mm. Now, you know, it did get a bad rap. Technically, it is also a tape. Now, again, there are probably some 8-tracks that sound better than others. Of course, for audio cassettes, you'd always want to try to get the chrome tapes because it just really quickly to backtrack to that just for 1 second.
Mm.
I had a record at home that I dubbed onto a Maxell gold chrome tape.
Oh,
and
yes,
I'm telling you, and I'm telling you, Kevin, I put this tape in my car and it was the best sounding recording of that record I ever had, better than vinyl. And it was just something about that quality of the tape that took the music and gave it just that little extra bit of dimension and warmth to it. Nice. But that record sounded just phenomenal on there. And so tape does have something for it. Now, also another thing that you got to remember about 8-tracks too is that while it did get a little bit of a bad rap for, you know, the way it was unable to take certain sequences of albums, some artists actually used 8-track to their advantage in some ways because, for example, if you were to own an 8-track version of Pink Floyd's Animals, when they have that Pigs on the Wing, the first part and the last part, and on the 8-track version of that, they sequenced those two back to back, but in the middle, they added a guitar solo piece that bridged those two pieces together. So, and that was actually played by Snowy White, I believe his name is, the guitar player who actually went on tour with them. And they actually used that as a different way of putting those two pieces together. And that also became a variation of that album.
Nice.
So 8-track is another way to get that album. And it is actually the only way that you'll be able to hear Pigs on the Wing Part 1 and Part 2 in that manner.
Yeah. Okay, well, 8-tracks really have completely disappeared. And it does seem to be mainly a car-based phenomenon for... as far as I can tell. And the only other different kind of tape that I can think of would be reel-to-reel. Were any Yes... Do you know of any Yes products were actually released on something like reel-to-reel?
Yeah, the funny thing is, if you go onto Discogs, as I was looking for, you know, my various different pressings of different records that I had, I believe I was looking for... I think it was a Grease version of Close to the Edge.
Right.
And while I was looking through it, I was scrolling through and I happened to come across something that said 4-track on it. I clicked on it.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, there is a version of Close to the Edge that you can buy on reel-to-reel 2-track tape.
Goodness me. That just sounds insane. I did use a reel-to-reel piece of equipment when I was in college. I think it must have been 20 years old even when I was in college, this thing. And we had some fascinating Indian raga music. So there was a rag that we had to transcribe as part of my musical studies, which was fascinating. So I had to use this reel-to-reel. But they were dreadful for going wrong and stretching the tape. And it's a terrible thing. Anyway, so moving a little bit further up to date, the next format that I experienced Yes on was 90125 on CD. And I used to love turning the volume up really loud and playing the opening of a Lonely Heart to get the difference between that dirty guitar sound and then Chris Squire's glissando from the top of his bass right down to the bottom. And suddenly it was all incredibly clean, the sound that came out of the CD. And so for things like 90125, I really enjoyed listening to it on that clean format. And I suppose 90125 was one of the first vaguely digital technique type albums, or at least that's how it seemed to me. What was the first CD you heard of Yes?
The first CD I heard of Yes, believe it or not, was Union. I'll never forget, though, hearing it the very first time, because one of my friends actually had a mate of mine who was in my band for a long while, he got his very first little compact stereo system that had a CD player, and then he got that right away and we put it on and listened to it. And I'll never forget how clear and loud this format was. I mean, you didn't need to turn up your stereo to like 5 to get a, you know, a decent volume. You could put it on 2 or 3 and it was already just like shaking the room, you know? And it was incredible because CD has always had, you know, on a plus side, the clarity aspect of it, how they say that, oh, suddenly you can hear everything. You can hear the reverbs better on the track. You can hear the tails of the delay on the voice a lot better. You can hear the strings on the acoustic guitars so much more clear. All these things were a plus to it. But then certain other types of music started complaining about it, saying that the digital format was too harsh. Like, for example, I remember there was a release of Judas Priest's Painkiller that came out on CD. And people are saying, when I put my headphones on, it was just like razor blades in the ears. Like, it was too clean. And just his guitar tone was just like so razor blade-ish. And that, again, the thing with CD is that it made certain formats of music have to step back, take a look at it, and maybe think of the way they recorded music for this medium a little bit differently. Maybe not so much top end, maybe not so much distortion.
Yeah.
You know, adjustments had to be made for that medium. You know, other music, it didn't have to. Jazz, it suited it very well. Classical music was a complete blessing, the CD, because it just made it that much more clear and audible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, I've enjoyed a lot of Yes music over the years on CD, and of course, the most recent remixes by Stephen Wilson, some of that is on CD, that's on other formats as well that we'll come back to in a minute. But I have to say that I am a devotee of CDs, even though you lose that large artwork and so on. So most of my Yes albums are on CD or vinyl, and I've got quite a few, obviously, on both. But moving on then to different formats, DVD-A, DVD audio, what on earth is that all about?
Well, DVD-A is a form of, obviously, digital, for music, right? It is a bigger format in terms of storage, number one. So you can make higher resolution audio and put it on there, because on DVD, I believe you can hold 4.9 gigs of information on it, whereas a regular CD, you can hold maybe 850, if you're lucky, megabytes on it. So if you were to get, you know, a 24-bit recording at, let's say, 48K kilohertz, you could put it nicely on a DVD-A, and it sounds, well, it is supposed to sound that much better for it. Like I mentioned once before, when you go up to that sort of higher resolution, I think you mainly notice it on stuff like reverbs and delays, where before it was maybe a little bit harder to pick out some of these little nuances. They become suddenly more clear. Cymbals become just a little bit more brighter, and the snare drum sounds a little bit more clear. You know, it's just that whole format on DVD was mainly made so that, you know, when you make like those whole kinds of like concert videos, you can put a slightly better variation of the audio in better quality to match the better quality of the video as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And is that why Blu-ray is used now, because it's got even more capacity? And when you're talking about 3.1 mixes and surround sound mixes and so on, and on the latest Stephen Wilson remixes, is that why Blu-ray is used?
Exactly, because Blu-ray can hold as much as 50 gigs on a blank Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of information, and if you look at some of these Stephen Wilson versions of it, they have, I believe, some needle drop versions of the album that they did as high as 24-bit, 192 kilohertz, which is like insane. I think like maybe my dog could hear some of that, you know, information, not us, right? But it's mainly because the whole idea of the Blu-ray initially was they wanted to look at it as a storage medium to keep information for years and years and years in a very high format. Now they used it also for the live concert experience as well, and for 5.1. And also it became very important, Blu-ray, because when they started introducing 7.1 surround, they needed that much more space for that information as well, right?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you have 7 speakers to throw around music in, and you know, you need to have that space for it. And the main thing I want to get to with the Blu-ray really quickly is I remember talking to an engineer about this once before, and he had this kind of interesting way to look at these different formats. Because cassette tape is supposed to be sort of an alternate to a 2-track recording. Mm. Okay. The CD is supposed to be the way to get the most accurate representation of whatever format you're listening to. If you drop a cassette recording onto CD, it'll give you the exact version of how that tape sounds. No questions asked.
Yeah.
You know, same with the vinyl. Now, when you go to Blu-ray or when you go to DVD, it's a step up. It's supposed to be, you know, a CD sort of on steroids, mm-hmm. right? Mm. Where you can have better information on it. But the main thing with Blu-ray, and if you ever see those super Blu-ray audio discs that they have, I believe Queen has one, Rush released a couple of them,
yeah.
that they have put on there, right on the packaging, that you're supposed to experience listening to this audio as if you were sitting in the control room of the recording studio listening to the multi-track tape. That's how accurate the Blu-ray audio experience is supposed to be. That's why it's so high in the definition, and that's the main selling point of it. And I do have all three Rush releases that came out in this Blu-ray audio, and while it is better, I mean, I have sat in lots of control rooms and studios, and it's close. Like, if you turn it up and you listen to it, you can kind of get that experience, like it's like coming off of a real master tape. It's really well done.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And I love all the different remixes and different ways in which you can now get Yes music. It's absolutely fantastic. But I suppose where we should end this conversation, which has been absolutely fascinating about all this, is referring back to the romance, which seems to be lost as soon as you go into digital, and you're talking about all different formats and so on. And the experience can be just as good, of course, and a revelation when you hear some of those Blu-ray mixes and so on. But the romance has gone, really, hasn't it? And the ultimate way of destroying the romance, perhaps, is by using the streaming services. So Spotify over here and Pandora and all those sorts of things. Then you're left with nothing physical at all, just listening to that. And perhaps that's one of the ways in which music has moved away from the album format, the long formats, and into single tracks. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you're into, but it doesn't seem to suit progressive music, longer format music, and album-based musicians, does it, streaming?
No, exactly. And I mean, there was a reason why bands like Pink Floyd for the longest time resisted these sort of digital sort of places, like, you know, Pandora and, you know, even iTunes and stuff like that. They refused to want to put their music into like singular play situations, because, like they say, a lot of their records are meant to be listened to beginning to end. That's the experience of it. The experience is lost when you just go, oh, okay, I'm going to go into here and let's see, Dark Side of the Moon, I'm just going to get money and that's it. Well, you've lost the whole experience of the record right there when you just pick out one song out of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, so you know, this whole digital generation of it, I think, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed and I'm going to knock on wood, that people right now are starting to realize this. And this is why I see a lot of young people now going into record stores and buying albums, because I think they're starting to realize the advantages of listening to music on vinyl and listening to music as a whole, instead of just going and loading up their iPods with individual songs from like 700 different artists. You know, why not just focus on one record and listen to it and enjoy the experience top to bottom?
Absolutely. Okay, well, that's been absolutely fascinating, each of those formats with its pluses and minuses, and some with rather more minuses, perhaps, for you as a Yes listener. So leave your comments on the yesmusicpodcast.com show notes for this episode and tell us which formats you prefer. Are you a diehard vinyl fan, or have you really enjoyed vinyl over the years and all the other different formats in between? So thank you very much indeed for that, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
Okay, so finally this week, we've been very privileged to be able to play some clips which have been lent to us, or given to us, by Mitch Lafon from his programme One on One with Mitch Lafon, where he's interviewed many, many of the greatest rock stars in the world. So he's been interviewing Alan White before the Japan tour, and here's the first clip that we'd like to just play to you and then have a quick chat about.
Let's just get into this back thing. You missed out on the summer tour. Are you fully recuperated at this point for the Japan tour?
I wouldn't say I was fully recuperated right now, but I'm actually feeling very good. I get a occasional kind of twinges and stuff like that, but I'm actually feeling pretty good to go.
Okay, so what do you think, Mark? He says he feels pretty good to go out there, but we have got Jay Shellen to back him up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I first heard that, and I'll be totally honest, I feel very comfortable knowing that Jay is going out with them, yeah, only because when I heard him say that, he still gets the occasional twinge in the back, and having mm-hmm. bad back myself and having experienced it, I felt a little concerned hearing that, because a bit, twinge here and there means that it's not fully healed yet. And that also means right now, I mean, he's just at home right now, probably relaxing, recuperating, and he's getting them now still. So now if he goes and sits behind a drum set and starts drumming for an hour and a half, who's to say that those twinges may not get worse? Hopefully they won't. And I'm also hoping that maybe he's, you know, sitting at home and practicing a bit to maybe get himself more physically prepared for it.
Yeah, yeah. And it was fascinating also to hear Alan, in the context of the programs that we've just done, in the context of the episodes that we've done just very recently, he was asked about Ramshackled, and this is what he said about that.
Ramshackled, the solo album that you put out, 1976, I guess. Talk to me about the idea behind that album and that period where sort of everybody was releasing their own solo albums. Was there ever a thought of becoming a solo artist, or was it just, here's this one expression, let me do it, let me get it out of my system, and then back to business?
Yeah, it basically was let it get out of my system. I'd spent maybe 3 or 4 years building up to that time before I joined Yes and John Lennon and all that kind of stuff with this band. And I thought this music was too good to just let it go. So we got back in the studio, and within 3 months we put this album together that I was proud of, because it had lots of jazz influence and stuff, you know. And that music really was the teaching process for moving into a band like Yes, that a lot of complex kind of things going on.
Is that something that you would like to revisit at some point and make another solo album, or is it too?
Nah, you know what? That was just a period in time, and I got it out of my system like everyone else did, and we were proud of the product. But you know what? A couple of the guys I haven't heard from for so many years. I know the keyboard player, he was in a car accident, and he's not around anymore. So they were great guys, and we had a lot of great time, but I don't revisit that area. But I've been thinking of revisiting a more ethnic kind of style of playing and pretty kind of worldly and stuff like that. So I'm in that area right now, I was creating.
Yeah, so I thought that was absolutely fascinating. Interesting that he agreed with us that it was a case of getting the music out of the system for various of the members of the band at the time. I'm always quite surprised how proud he is of Ramshackled, because if you go back and listen to our thoughts about it, we were slightly less impressed. But fascinating that he thought it was a kind of training ground where he learned his craft with those musicians before coming into Yes. And as you said, I think in your review, it was very much a thank you to them. But also at the end there, he was mentioning that he definitely doesn't want to go back and do anything like that again, but that he might be thinking of bringing some more world ethnic type music in. And no wonder if we might see that at some point.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, it's interesting to, when you hear an interview like that, where people's mindsets are at the moment, right? When, yes. I mean, obviously he listens to this type of music now, if he's even bringing it up now. And the thing that I'm very happy about hearing that segment of the interview is that it answered a very important question that I had about the record, and how I mentioned before that on the information that I had, it said that they took 2 days recording this record. Now, yes. either that information is incorrect, because he clearly states that they spent 3 months on it.
Yeah.
Now, and number two, obviously, if they did go in and spend that little of time, now I can understand maybe why, because if he had had this music for 3 years with this group already, this has probably already been music that they've been playing long time before, and it was just a matter of like a bike getting back on and relearning it again really quickly, and they probably already had the feel of it and knew what they wanted to do with it. So sure, maybe they could have did it in 2 days, but I'm glad that he mentioned that they did spend, you know, time on it,
yeah,
and not just 2 days. So I'm guessing that that was just a piece of information that's incorrect. And of course, you know, the internet is always correct. So why am I not surprised?
Absolutely right. Well, he's talking about not going back to that, but then Mitch asked him specifically about a new Yes album. So let's see what he says about that.
Is there a new Yes album in the offing?
You know what? Everybody's got music in their minds because everybody involved with the camp, you know, is basically we do stuff at home and everybody got stuff in their minds. And yeah, we've all got, you've got to get that stuff out of your brain and get it recorded and then work on new stuff. So everybody's very enterprising in that area.
Is it important, like a band for Yes, at this point, to come up with new music? Because, you know, listen, let's be honest. You put your name on the marquee, you're going to get the fans that you're going to get. Is it important to actually create something new?
Of course it is. I mean, you know, I mean, Yes have always been a band that looks over the horizon, not at it, you know, and that's the difference. So, you know, we've got stuff that we've all got in our heads that we want to get out to the public.
It's interesting listening to that again and thinking, at some points in his answer, I was thinking, well, does he mean yes? Does he mean that there is definitely one happening? Or is he being slightly more hesitant about it?
Well, it's answered like a true musical politician, isn't it? I mean, he's answering it, but not answering it, you know? And on one hand, when I hear this sort of a piece from him, I just can't help but hear in the back of my head, you know, the voice in the back saying, Steve Howe's holding out, Steve Howe's holding out, Steve Howe's holding out, you know, and that's probably the reason, because, I mean, as he said, everybody has stuff that they're working on. Everybody's very enterprising. We all know how enterprising Billy Sherwood is with music. Mm. We all know how much, you know, people like, you know, John Davison, he can write a lot of music. You know, it seems like everybody, Jeff Downs, can write music quite quickly and effectively, you know, and it just seems like the only one who seems to have an issue with maybe moving on seems to be Steve. Now, I could be wrong, of course, but I just can't help but feel that whenever I hear a segment like that, because obviously he's not going to throw anybody under the bus here at this point. Because you can tell that they desperately want to do it, and that's why he's being so delicate with his answer.
Yes, 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 that's right. Well, we will probably never know what the internal politics are like. And one thing that is for sure, unfortunately, is, of course, that this will be the first Yes album without Chris Squire, if it does happen. And it was great to hear some reflections and recollections from Alan about Chris, and this is what he said about that.
Well, we had a phone call, and I think he actually knew at that time that he wasn't going to come out of the thing with leukemia. And he just said, you know, Alan, just keep doing what you do and keep, yes, moving on like we started it. And, you know, that's the last time I spoke to him, basically.
Again, my condolences for his passing. You know, some fans sometimes criticize when a band goes on. Was it difficult for you to continue on, or was it the proper thing to do to sort of honor the band, honor his legacy, and just keep moving forward?
No, absolutely. That was the proper thing to do. And, you know, since then we've done quite a few tours and stuff like that. So, you know, we're just keeping the movement of Yes Music going.
So I find that absolutely brilliant to hear that Alan really wants to keep going as Chris Squire wanted him to, and the band to, and of course he'll be there in Japan. So sounding bright, sounding pleased that he's returning to the band and looking forward to the future, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's always a sad topic to talk about when you talk about the passing of somebody like Chris Squire, who was so integral to the band. And, you know, it's good to hear that he wanted them to continue on. I mean, I'm pretty sure he wanted that anyways, no matter what, for the band to continue, even if he was alive today and they had all retired, I'm pretty sure he still wanted Yes music to continue in some sort of capacity, just like Rick Wakeman said in a few interviews. So I think it's great that they are moving ahead, and I think that Chris is smiling down at them.
Yes, absolutely right. So thank you very much indeed to Mitch Lafon for letting us play those clips. It's great to have that as part of the Yes Music podcast. And we did say that we would make sure we would give out the contact information for Mitch and where you can find him. So here's Mitch himself giving you those contact details.
So please check me out on Twitter at Mitch Lafon, MitchLafon. Same thing on Instagram, except there's an underscore between the Mitch and the Lafon. One-on-one, Mitch Lafon on Facebook and paypal.me/MitchLafon. That is just a lot of Mitch Lafon for you, isn't there? But there you go. Bye for now. Thank you for listening, and au revoir.
So, great. Thank you very much indeed, Mitch, for that. And thank you for everything, Mark. A little bit of a longer episode this week, I think, but it's been absolutely fascinating. So thank you.
You're welcome, Kevin.
I've had all Yes Music podcasts every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've had all Yes Music podcasts every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We'll be back next week with something a bit different. But in the meantime, please do get yourself involved with the podcast by any of the means on yesmusicpodcast.com or by signing up as a patron or by visiting Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. And so until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.